University Laboratory High School students in Urbana interviewed 15 East Central Illinois men and women regarding their struggle for gender equity.
I think women have always known how capable they are. We just didn't have the opportunity.
Listen to their stories and Rethinking Assumptions, The Quest for Gender Equity in East Central Illinois, July 25th at 6 p.m. here on WILL AM 580.
It's 2:41. In sports, the Chicago White Sox are wrapping up a four-game set with the Tampa Bay Rays this afternoon in Chicago. The Sox have taken two of the first three games in this series with the defending American League champions. In the top of the sixth, Chicago leads Tampa Bay, the score 5-0. The St. Louis Cardinals take their shrinking lead in the NL Central Division into the nation's capital tonight for a makeup game against the Washington Nationals. Adam Wainwright is the scheduled starter for St. Louis. The Cardinals lead the idle Chicago Cubs by just one game and begin a series with the red-hot Philadelphia Phillies tomorrow night. 4 days after his heart-wrenching playoff defeat to Stuart Sink at Turnberry, Tom Watson shot a 3-under-67 today to begin his pursuit of a fourth senior British Open title. The 59-year-old Watson, who almost became the oldest major champion at the British Open last weekend, was tied for third place among early finishers at Sunningdale. And Tiger Woods has decided to play in the Buick Open as he prepares for the first major of the year. Woods announced today he would return to the Buick Open, which he has won twice. His longtime endorsement deal with Buick ended early last year, and there were questions whether Woods would play. That's sports. General Motors continues its efforts to reinvent itself and become a more efficient company. Yesterday, a federal bankruptcy judge granted the company's request to break its contract with a mining firm in Montana. That decision allows GM to shift to cheaper foreign suppliers. Emily Ritter reports from Montana Public Radio.
Stillwater Mining Company employs 1,300 people and is the only platinum and palladium mine in the U.S. And for the last decade, it supplied GM with the metals needed to make catalytic converters. Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer says GM has every legal right to pull out of the contract, but he says it's not smart.
I love my Chevy pickup, but I'm going to park it and put the hood up. And it's time for General Motors to recognize that if they're going to be a partner with the United States of America, if they want our taxpayers to bail them out, they can't turn around and do this to a very important mine.
Stillwater argued GM should honor the contract because it received some $50 billion in government loans. But as GM emerges from federal bankruptcy protection, the automaker says it can't afford to maintain every contract. GM spokesman Dan Flores says the Stillwater mine is no longer competitive price-wise.
We are committed to running our business as efficiently, as cost-competitive as possible, because that is the best way that we can return and repay our federal loans and to provide a good return on the taxpayer investment.
GM is keeping two other palladium mines, one in Russia and one in South Africa. Stillwater estimates it will lose up to $10 million a year until 2012, when the contract with GM was set to expire. For NPR News, I'm Emily Ritter in Helena, Montana.
The GM story is an all about shrinking and closing down. Yesterday, GM held a ribbon-cutting ceremony to celebrate the opening of a brand-new $100 million auto test facility in Yuma, Arizona. From member station KAWC, Steve Proffitt reports.
GM partnered with the Army to build this new 2,400-acre facility at the famed Yuma Proving Ground. For generations, military engineers have tested everything from Bradley fighting vehicles to heavy artillery here. Now, GM will be testing all its cars here. The sweet part for the Army, they get to use the track to test military vehicles for free.
The Army needed a capability to test vehicles at a high rate of speed in the desert environment.
Colonel John Bullington, commander of the Yuma Proving Ground, notes that most of this country's military activity in the past generation has taken place in desert environments. He led the negotiations with GM.
We got the capability for free. This didn't cost the taxpayer a dime. We had the state-of-the-art facility on Yuma Proving Ground, and it's a benefit that really is just win-win for everyone.
For GM, this Army base offers them free land and an ultra-high security zone where they can test their new cars. Ken Morris is a GM exec in charge of vehicle testing.
This feels like the new General Motors, where we're breaking away from the things that we've struggled through here in the past, and we're ready to step on the throttle and move into being a fantastic company again.
At the center of the GM facility, there's a big garage where mechanic Jim Miller and his team are torture testing a prototype transmission. They've bolted it into a Camaro with a 550-horsepower engine.
Well, this car runs all day long, wide-open throttle launches.
At 120 miles an hour, in 110-degree heat, oh, and there's no air conditioning. This is nirvana for a car nut. Outside the garage, there are a series of tracks carved into the baking landscape and a huge paved area called a pad. Mechanic Shan Smith took me for a spin, turning tight circles on the pad in a Pontiac Solstice, searching for the speed at which the vehicle might spin out. There's a nice banked raceway for high-speed testing and a track that looks like a highway engineer's nightmare with every manner of bump, pothole, wobble, and wave. Local officials hope GM will help take some of the bumps out of the local economy here. Unemployment is well above 20%, and the facility brings about 100 good-paying jobs to Yuma. Most of the workers moved here from Mesa, Arizona, where GM closed a test facility that they'd run there for 50 years. They're happy to have the work. Still, some, like Jim Miller, the guy testing the transmission, are worried about their jobs.
They've closed plants, you know, in a heartbeat, you know, that they have more money in than this. So there are still a lot of people that are nervous about that right now.
For NPR News, I'm Steve Proffitt in Yuma, Arizona.
Coming up this afternoon on The World, Cambodians rely on a diet of fish. The nation's fishing fleet is concentrated on one huge lake, the Tonle Sap. This lake has fed Cambodians throughout history, but overfishing threatens the annual catch, and shoreline development endangers the lake's future. That story from Cambodia in the day's news coming up on The World this afternoon here on AM 580 at 3 o'clock. We go now to France and the supermarket Cinderella story. A cashier in France has become a literary sensation. 29-year-old Anna Sam turned her routine job into a humorous memoir. Now her book has been translated into 16 languages and turned Sam into the author she always wanted to be. Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris.
Tribulations of a Cashier is a sociological study of the grocery store world from the viewpoint of the checkout girl. In Anna Sam's book, she dissects the behavior of the shopper, like in this extract read by an actor.
It's lunchtime, and your first customer of the day is stuffing his mouth with a tuna salad sandwich. Chewing noisily, his mouth wide open, you get a glimpse of every ingredient. When you ask to borrow his sandwich for a moment to scan the price, he takes one more giant bite before handing it over. So what's a little mayonnaise on your fingers and crumbs on your register?
Sam presents other shopper types, like the mothers who regularly warn their children that if they don't shape up, they'll grow up to be nothing but a cashier, and the sleazeballs who hit on her while trying to steal CDs inside their boxes of camembert. Despite the indignation, Sam says in some ways the job actually made her feel good about herself.
It's a job where you see every people. It's a job where no one sees you. You see families very happy, family very sad, people very nice, people very bad. And at the end of your day, you say, oh my God, I'm happy because I have a normal life. I'm better than I thought.
By taking a job as a cashier, you have also chosen the best route to a super new shape. The cashier's perch is the perfect place to tighten those buttocks, build those biceps, and yes, ladies, even firm up those breasts. Just compare yourself to a customer or a new checkout girl who doesn't have the firming experience you have behind you.
Sam began working as a cashier during college to support her literature studies. When graduation came and went, no other jobs were available, so she stayed on and on. 5 years passed. The work was ungratifying and mind-numbing until she decided to write about it.
I started to see my job different, to see differently people. When you start to explain it with humor, people say, oh, what a funny blog, what a funny diary. I think everything we live can be funny. We have just to see with a good eye.
The automatic gestures and sentences repeated thousands of times a day aren't exactly conducive to cognitive development, but they will permit you to put your esprit on automatic pilot. Enjoy the mental relaxation. You can pick up your faculties on your way out of the store at the end of the day.
Sam first started writing in a blog where she provided a running account of what went on in the world of a cashier. Titled Caissière No Futur, her blog attracted a large number of readers, then newspaper reporters. Soon, publishing houses took note, and Sam had several book offers.
Bonjour, Anna Sam.
Bonjour.
Donc vous êtes,
Since her first book, Sam has become the toast of TV and radio talk shows. With a second book, also about the supermarket world, just off the press, Sam has now left her till behind for good. It wasn't all bad, she says, and reads one of her favorite chapters about how the cash register beeping could sometimes transport you into a dreamlike state.
Il y a foule dans le magasin. Les chariots se croisent toujours plus nombreux.
The store is packed. Shoppers rush to and fro. Their grocery carts squeak and rattle. A voice over the intercom barks out the latest sales promotions over a backdrop of jangling music. The general brouhaha intensifies. The store is approaching its maximum sound threshold. The squalling of a brat tips it over the edge, opening the passageway to this other dimension.
Sam says her success has been a wonderful surprise. She is heartened to hear from cashiers who say they now find hope and humor in their daily grind. But what makes her happiest, she says, is that people tell her they now treat the checkout girl with respect. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
For animals in most zoos and aquariums, the door from freedom to captivity swings just one way. But at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, sea otters from its exhibits teach wild sea otter orphans how to survive in the ocean. Anne Dornfeld has the story.
Rosa has her baby in a headlock. That's actually how southern sea otters hold their young.
The pup is essentially unconscious. It's very much asleep, and Rosa is holding it as a female would in the wild. She's got it sort of teed off her side with a paw around its neck.
Andy Johnson is the director of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Sea Otter Research and Conservation Program. By the end of the 19th century, sea otters had been hunted to extinction in some parts of the Pacific. Lillian Carswell is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She says these days, pollution and disease are sea otters' biggest threats. And she says a lot of other species depend on otter survival.
Sea otters are important for a number of reasons. One is that they're a top predator in the nearshore marine ecosystem, and they play an important role in structuring what that ecosystem looks like.
Hungry sea otters keep sea urchin populations in check. When urchins overpopulate an area, they can mow down entire kelp forests that provide food and shelter for hundreds of species. So to help conserve the otter population, Andy Johnson and his team at the Monterey Bay Aquarium pair orphan pups from the wild with the female exhibit otters. The goal is for the surrogate mothers to not only care for the pups, but also to teach them all the skills they'll need to be released back into the wild at about 6 months old. A volunteer has just tossed some food into the pool where Rosa and the orphan pup are swimming. Rosa grabs the live crab as the pup watches.
Rosa's quite skilled with those, so she'll pretty much take that apart in a few minutes. I'll watch the pup and see if the pup approaches the crab without getting pinched. I have to admit it's quite amusing to see these young animals confronting these crabs, because the crabs are pretty formidable on their own.
Rosa ends up breaking off a leg for her adopted pup, who decides the shell is too much work. Before long, though, the pup will learn some of the same impressive skills that adult sea otters have, like how to use tools to open clams and urchins. Before the surrogate program began, workers and volunteers used to hand-rear these pups. They'd even take the pups swimming in Monterey Bay to acclimate them to their future home. But that made the released otters expect food from boaters and other people they encountered in the bay. Now that surrogate moms raise the otters, the goal is for the pups to never see or hear a human. We've been watching these sea otters interact from a TV monitor near the pool. To get up close to the pup, I have to put on a Darth Vader costume of sorts, starting with a huge black nylon poncho.
This is a welding mask?
Very cheap welding mask.
Rosa isn't fooled. As I approach the pool, she shoots over to see whether I have food. Rosa was a rescued pup. She was hand-reared before the surrogate program began. After she was released into Monterey Bay, she had to be recaptured because she was jumping on kayaks and divers.
And we found that with the sea otters, putting them with an adult female animal in a fairly shallow pool for 6 months, you know, far outweighs whatever we were doing trying to raise these pups.
Sea otter populations are recovering at a slow pace in California, but this program is contributing to the population. Johnson says the apparent survival rate of the re-released pups is now about as good as that of newly weaned pups in the wild. Some have even successfully raised their own pups, using skills they picked up from an exhibit otter at the aquarium. For the Environment Report, I'm Ann Dornfeld.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
Earth and Sky.
Andy Jarvis has been using computer models to study how climate change will affect the world's 50 most important crops. Jarvis spoke with Earth Sky from his office at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture in Colombia. He said that previous studies have focused primarily on just wheat, corn, and rice.
Food security on a global level depends on a lot more than those three big crops. You know, you've got things like barley, sorghum, soybean, things like sugar cane. Here in Latin America, you've got coffee, for example.
Jarvis is a geographer. He's been using data on rainfall, growing season, and temperature, plus existing climate models, to figure out which crops will grow where as climate change progresses in this century. He spoke, for example, about Africa's Sahel region.
These are some of the hottest areas of the world, and so they lose a lot of options. And they're almost, what our models are showing, is almost left really with just the option of growing millets, which